Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, RFRL's Monday podcast about significant developments and upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Steve Gutterman, and my guest this week is Sam Green, a professor at the Russia Institute at King's College London, director of Democratic Resilience at the Center for European Policy Analysis, and co-author of the book Putin versus the People. Sam, thank you very much for finding the time to join me this week. It's great to have you on the podcast.
Well, it's great to be here, Steve. Great to be back with you, and thanks for the invitation.
All right. Now, the first thing I want to talk about, actually, the introduction to this podcast, significant developments and upcoming events, sounds sort of trite sometimes now, but in fact, there are very significant developments and events upcoming. The first thing I want to talk about is something that started last week, but it's continuing now and seems likely to have major repercussions for months, if not years, to come. I'm talking about the mobilization that Putin ordered with a decree last week amid what had been persistent manpower problems for the Russian military and its war on Ukraine. And also following more recent setbacks there, most notably a counteroffensive in which Ukrainian forces have retaken swaths of land that Russia had seized, mostly in the Kharkiv region, north of the Donbass. Now, Putin, in his decree and in his comments and other Russian officials are calling this a partial mobilization. But there are serious doubts that it's really just partial. Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu said the aim is to call up 300,000 men. But there are reports that the Kremlin's real target figure may be 1 million or more, up to 1.2 million. And we'll talk about the potential effect on the war itself a little later. But so far, the mobilization order has had a very visible effect, its most visible effect in Russia. And it's becoming more and more visible by the day, it seems to me. There are protests that are being dispersed roughly by riot police in many cases. Some ongoing kind of protests in the North Caucasus, among other places. And there are also large numbers of people, mainly young men, trying to leave the country. Lines, very long lines at borders with Georgia and Mongolia, among other countries, many, many, many people fleeing or attempting to flee to Kazakhstan and other countries that border Russia. Sam, you've written and spoken about various aspects of the mobilization, including the issue of whether ethnic minorities and poorer people in Russia are bearing the brunt. And the mobilization has clearly made it much harder for many Russians to essentially ignore the war in Ukraine, which I would say is something that had amounted or amounts to tacit support. People kind of going about their business or trying to, and when they're asked about the war, saying, I don't want to talk about it, or something like that. So this has changed that, for millions of Russians. I'm going to frame the question this way, Sam. Obviously, the mobilization will result in even more death and suffering in Ukraine, and it's terrible news for many Russians as well. It will increase the death toll among Russian soldiers, which Shoigu said last week is less than 6,000, but Western intelligence estimates put at 15,000 or more, possibly much more. So my question is, for Putin, is the mobilization a huge mistake?
It's a great question, Steve, and it's a difficult one to answer in large measure because, I mean, for Putin, I mean, this whole war has been a huge mistake, right? I mean, it wasn't ever going to be capable of achieving, at least victory on the terms that he set out. It has done, tremendous amounts of damage, obviously, to Ukraine and cost thousands of lives in ways that have been tragic and criminal. But you know, even if you just take a sort of a cynical perspective of you know what his interests are, it's made him you know the leader of a poorer and less secure country, and it's really attacked a lot of the structures that had been you know important to you know, keeping him legitimate and to keeping him in power. So to the extent that this mobilization is a continuation of this war and something that's designed to enable him to continue the war, not necessarily to win it, although we'll I suppose come back to that question. But you know, to that extent, it is you know, a continuation of the same mistake. It's a doubling down of all of the risks, right? One of which was always going to be the risk of, you know, how does the Russian public deal with this war, right? I mean, he, you know, obviously, you know, one way or another had some bad analysis, right, going into this war way back in February, right? He thought he was going to be able to win this rather quickly. But one of the things he also thought, right, was that he was going to be able to shield the Russian public broadly from this war. And so, you know, he said at the outset, there's not going to be mobilization. There's not going to be a draft. We're not going to call people up, right? And in fact, he didn't do a lot ahead of the war to actually prepare, you know, people, you know, to say, you know, to say nothing of preparing them for mobilization. He didn't really even prepare them for the war. Russian public opinion was broadly caught off guard by this. Even the Russian state television was broadly caught off guard by this and didn't really know how to cover it, how to frame it, and how to spin it in the early days and weeks of the war. You know, which does indicate that he had things to be worried about, or he felt that he had things to be worried about in terms of how the Russian public would respond to that. And we are seeing that play out now on the streets, in border crossings, and in towns and communities, and in the private lives of Russians around, you know, the country. You said something, you know, about, you know, whether or not, you know, trying to sort of keep quiet on the war, right, amounts to tacit support. And there's a moral question in there, right, which, you know, everybody will decide, you know, on their own what's the appropriate way of facing things. But, you know, the reality is that from a political perspective and from a perspective of Putin getting what he wanted and getting away with the violence that he was doing, not just to Ukraine, but to Russia, right, it is true that you know, decision to sort of ignore the war, to keep your head down, you know, did function essentially as tacit support. One of the things it allowed people to do was to look around them and believe that, in fact, there was a consensus in support of this war. And that meant that people could, you know, were more likely to stay on board with it. Now, I think, you know, people look around and they see a somewhat different picture, right? Individuals are now faced with, in many cases, the impossibility of ignoring the war. Right, they face the choice of making what is, you know, again, morally maybe not a difficult decision, but in terms of your life course, a difficult decision between, you know, do you go and allow yourself to become an instrument of violence and war in another country, or do you face, you know, 10 years in jail potentially for evading the draft or for desertion, right? That for a lot of people will be a difficult choice to make. And that's led to people, you know, seeking ways to avoid that particular dilemma, right? Whether that's by protesting and trying to create political change, or whether that's by heading for the border, right? So in a lot of ways, I think, you know, Putin has made this situation more acute for himself, and yes, double down on that mistake. I mean, he will, of course, have felt that there was, you know, reason for him to do this. He was under pressure from public opinion, and he was under pressure. He feels under pressure, right, clearly to make some progress in this war, or at the very least to keep the Ukrainians from making progress in the war. He will be, you know, aware of the risks of what he's doing, and he, you know, inevitably will have made the calculation that the risks are worth the potential reward. Whether or not that, you know, turns out in his favor, I mean, I'm not going to predict the future, but we're going to have to wait and see.
Yes, absolutely. Very hard to predict the future. Thanks very much. Some great points about both the things that were happening at the beginning around the time of the invasion, and then also now, you know, around the time of the invasion, where Putin obviously did not expect to have to draft people, conduct this mobilization 7 months later. And the consensus is that he believed his goals or the subjugation of Ukraine would be achieved very quickly. So obviously that would be something that would be much easier for many Russians to swallow, whether or not they cared much about it. But on the other hand, it's difficult. I mean, I think I wrote at the beginning and others, and as you mentioned, the war itself and ordering the invasion was a big mistake, and presumably may turn out to have been kind of a fatal political mistake for Putin, in addition to what it's done, to the lives of many, many people. But then again, 7 months later, we're here. He's still ruling Russia, and the war is still going on. And now we're talking about another mistake. So as you say, again, it's hard to predict what's going to happen. And it's even hard, I think. I don't know. You've seen kind of the more and more footage from regions where people are protesting the war. Not huge numbers, but quite vocal in many cases. And it's kind of hard to gauge, I think, what is going to happen as a result of that. Now, I'd also like to hear your thoughts, and you mentioned this, about how the mobilization may actually affect the course of the war, of Russia's war against Ukraine. But I'm going to combine that with kind of the other big development that occurred last week. A day before Putin announced the so-called partial mobilization, Russian imposed administrators in four Ukrainian regions that are partially controlled by Russian forces abruptly announced last Tuesday that they would hold so-called referendums on joining Russia, and those would start last Friday. These processes, I hesitate to even call them votes, have been denounced as a sham by Kiev, Western countries, and the UN for many reasons. They don't correspond to international law, among other things. There's a war going on, and there are several other reasons. An expert told RFRL that they would have, quote, no legitimacy whatsoever, unquote. But in any case, these processes in the four regions ends tomorrow. And Russia seems certain to use it to claim that the Luhansk, Donetsk, Kherson, and Zaporizhia regions of Ukraine are parts of Russia, as it did with Crimea in 2014. And in fact, it appears that on Friday, September 30th, Putin may deliver his annual address to Parliament, to the nation, and what Russia would consider the annexation, or the Russian, these regions becoming part of Russia, will be, in Russia's eyes, it looks like that may be finalized on Friday as well. In his address, in which he announced the mobilization, Putin also offered support for the referendums, which are obviously organized by Moscow. And he issued a very thinly veiled threat to potentially use nuclear weapons if these regions are attacked, which, once they become part of Russia, which they clearly will be, at least in Russia's eyes. Ukraine, of course, is not attacking another country. It's defending itself. But the chances that it will stop fighting and essentially hand those regions over to Russia are zero or very, very close to it. But let me get to my question, Sam. Sorry. With the Russian mobilization and these processes in the four Ukrainian regions, is the war about to enter a new phase? And if so, what might it look like?
Yeah, I wish I knew the answer to that question. I'm very far from being a military analyst. But I think this war is being fought on two fronts. And I think that what we're seeing both with the referenda and the mobilization is intended to have an impact on both fronts. I think that Putin, you know, remains uncertain about exactly what can be achieved on either front, right? He's learning a lot about his military as this war goes on. And whatever confidence he had in it must have been undermined, at least to some extent. And so he must have questions in his own mind about, you know, how much these, you know, 300,000 troops are going to be able to achieve once they do get to the border. We're getting some indication that some of them are getting to the front very, very, very quickly, essentially without any training at all. Others may take some more time, right? It would be, you know, ridiculous to suggest that it's not intended to have an impact on the front lines itself, and on the course of the fighting. At the very least, as I said earlier, I think that there's, you know, a hope in Moscow and in the military command that this would at least make it a little bit harder for the Ukrainians to keep advancing, and would increase the toll that Ukrainian troops pay for any territory that they are able to take back. But I think that the mobilization, together with these referenda, right, are intended to alter the cost benefit analysis and the calculations that are made in Kyiv and in Western capitals. Right, they are intended to make it maybe a little bit easier for decision makers on the other side, right, to come to the conclusion that maybe it's time to stop fighting. I mean, look, nobody thinks that the peace deal is on the table, and Putin, I think, doesn't see one as achievable. Certainly not one that would recognize, Russian political control, formal control over the territory that it has. But anything that would, you know, ramp down the pace of the fighting, that would make it possible for him to stop taking losses, maybe to reduce some of the political pressure at home, maybe to reduce some of the pressure that he's getting from Beijing, looking back to the summit in Tashkent just recently, would be beneficial to him, right? And so I think that there is some hope, on his side that this might, help to achieve that. Looking from the outside, as you said, it's impossible to imagine Kyiv deciding that it's time to stop fighting. And it's sitting here in Washington and talking to people in London and other places, it's frankly equally impossible to imagine Western capitals at the moment putting pressure on Kyiv to stop fighting. And so I don't think that Putin is going to achieve anything in that regard, right? At which point that will, put the onus back on his decision making in terms of what actually happens on the physical, on the battlefield front, right? The military front, rather than kind of the diplomatic and psychological front in this war. He will then have to decide whether or not it's actually, serves his purposes to escalate. His military will have to decide whether it actually has the capability of escalating and withstanding whatever the consequences of that escalation might be. I think, again, it would be inappropriate and unwise to discount the possibility of that escalation. But when I talk to people here in Washington and sort of hear the tenor of the conversations in London and other places, I don't get the impression that Western leaders are minded to take these threats very seriously. Right. There is a difficult balance that they've tried to maintain from the beginning of this war, which is, on the one side, a very clear desire to make sure that Russia does not win, to make sure that no signal is sent that you can, handle international relations this way. But at the same time, to prevent this from escalating and causing more devastation, right? And there's an obvious tension, right, between those two things, right? That the less, the more you hedge, the less you try to escalate, the more likely it becomes that Russia can turn this into a war of attrition in which, its gains may not be formalized, but they will become de facto gains for Russia. Clearly Moscow at the moment is trying to turn things in that direction at minimal cost to itself, and by threatening through ultimatums and this kind of of rhetoric. And again, I'm not hearing a lot of willingness here, right, to be drawn into that kind of game. But of course, there is, you know, there is a risk on the other side of that.
Thanks. That's very, very helpful. It kind of reminds me, I feel the same. You said sort of a tension between two kind of things. It sort of reminds me of the run-up, the build-up to the invasion, you know, where Russia was making these big demands on the U.S. and NATO and Ukraine. It was hard to see, you know, the diplomacy was tried, but it was really hard to see, despite the fact that it seemed unbelievable to many, including me, that Russia would really go ahead, that Putin would really go ahead with this invasion. It seemed difficult to understand how he could not, after making the demands that Russia had made, you know, permanent Ukraine not joining NATO, other countries also staying out of NATO permanently, you know, kind of a rollback of some of the results of the Soviet collapse and the end of the Cold War. So I find myself at least thinking sort of a similar situation now where, you know, Putin is kind of ratcheting up the threats and the stakes, I guess, with this mobilization. It's hard to understand, you know, how we could back down, but then you have also the, you know, the fact that it's unclear what the mobilization will actually achieve in terms of gains or preventing further Ukrainian gains or retaking of territory. I guess I just want to ask one additional question, if you don't mind. Do you think that the effect that this mobilization and the other developments have on the war will kind of affect how it plays out in Russia in terms of, you know, does this go toward more serious and more widespread opposition to the war and opposition to the government and Putin, you know, or does it sort of fizzle out if Russia seems to kind of hold its own or do what Putin would probably want it to do?
I mean, clearly, look, I think if this does lead to, you know, a sea change on the battlefield, again, I don't know anybody who expects that to happen. But if it does, then you know, then Putin will have dodged a bullet. I think anything short of that, right, the Putin will have to be very, very careful. Right. You know, Russians, there's all this debate, you know, now about, you know, why we don't see larger protests in Russia, and people comparing developments, you know, there to developments in Ukraine in the past, or developments in Belarus and other places. And you know, that's a very long and complicated conversation. But, you know, the reality is that, you know, Russians do protest, and Russians have, even with relatively small scale protests, you know, been able to force the government to change course on a regular basis, right? You can go back to things like, you know, benefits reforms and social welfare reforms in 2005. You can look at housing reforms and education reforms, and you can even look, you know, back to the beginning of the pandemic when the Kremlin tried to go for you know, reasonably stringent you know, pandemic restrictions, right? And public resistance really forced them to turn back on that, right? And we can again have a very long and interesting and complicated conversation about, you know, the kinds of things that Russians do and don't mobilize against, and why politics is often not one of them. But you know, there is a longstanding pattern of Russians, you know, mobilizing in defense of their personal livelihoods, not just material livelihoods, but their autonomy, right? And this is, you know, the kind of thing that really can impinge on that, right? So if people, you know, do begin to feel that they can't maintain their autonomy in this context, and if people do begin to feel that, in fact, this is not going to be limited, right? If Putin does make it clear tacitly or otherwise that that this mobilization is going to go beyond 300,000 people, that really nobody is going to be safe from it one way or another, then I think that there is at least the potential for them to face some very real resistance, which can have unpredictable consequences.
Absolutely. It's a great answer. Now, I'm going to, we're starting to run short on time. I'm going to turn to some questions from listeners. We have a few already, so I'll start reading those. And one question is, now this you touched on this somewhat, Sam. If the referendums go in favor of Russia and those areas become part of Russia, and of course, that would be in Russia's eyes. I'm interjecting here. And NATO continues its military support for Ukraine. What will be the scenario? And you mentioned that you did talk about that, but maybe you could expand a little if possible, Sam.
What the scenario is really hard to know. I don't imagine. Again, it's very difficult for me to imagine. Ukrainian military commanders deciding, okay, right now, Russia's drawn a line and we can't cross it. Right, that would be untenable, right? And it would undermine, I think, the Ukrainian war effort broadly. And again, I really don't think so. We have, seen, for example, the Biden administration here in the U.S. put limitations on the sorts of arms and on the potential use of arms that it's provided to Ukraine to make sure that this war does not, get fought on Russian territory proper, right? Clearly has not prevented Ukraine from striking, even in Crimea, which, the U.S. and really nobody else, right? The U.S. and everybody else recognizes as Ukrainian territory rather than Russian, right? And I think the same kind of principle would extend to any of these oblasts that Russia, may decide to claim as its own, right? So my initial inclination is to think that the war will continue. It will continue to cross those lines, and we will have to wait and see, right? What kind of escalation Moscow decides to pursue? I think some degree of escalation is probably almost, unfortunately, almost inevitable.
Okay, thanks for that, Sam. Thanks very much. There's a request to speak from Piotr Kurzin. So we'll give you speaking privilege and you can ask the question, Piotr.
Oh, thank you very much. I didn't expect to be to join, but I appreciate the space, Sam. I've followed your work for a bit. I myself actually come from Russia partially. And I'm just curious. I must admit, I'm a little bit surprised by your framing of some of your positions. I think that this is pretty serious that we're seeing, and from what I understand, historically Russians don't tend to mobilize and sort of protest unless it's a really, really serious thing. I'm very concerned by the direction that the war is going. I do think there's been a sea change with the seismic counteroffensive that the Ukrainians have conducted and continue to do. So I'm just curious how you think that this is going to play into the longer term stabilization within Russia. We don't have a clear replacement for Putin. I draw a lot of parallels to 1917 in sort of that we've got, a front where Russia's losing a lot. The economy is basically flatlining, but there's no clear sort of Lenin character to sort of come through and really replace the current incumbent regime. So just curious how you think that this is going to play into Russia's broader stabilization and therefore its interests in other sort of near abroad theaters like say the Caucasus or the Central Asian states. Thank you.
Wow, great set of questions, Steve. I don't know if we have another hour to deal with all of this, but I think relatively briefly. Look, I'm not, you know, unconcerned about any of this. I think that the potential for escalation is real, right? The potential for mobilization at home, as in civic mobilization, not military mobilization, is also real. And, you know, it's true that, you know, what we tend not to see in Russia when it comes to protest movements are large-scale political movements. We have seen some, right? They tend to run into very real limitations. And you know, there's a lot of reasons behind that. But one of which is that, you know, Russians, by and large, the problem in Russian politics for the Russian opposition is not that people think that the country is well-governed, right? The problem has historically been and remains that most people don't believe that if you were to have a change of government, that things would improve in their lives. Again, we could have a long conversation about what, you know, why you don't have that sensibility in places like Ukraine, for example. But that is, you know, generally the issue in Russia, right? But when, you know, push with their backs to the wall, and even on things we might think of as relatively minor, right? You do get, you know, protest movements, again, around things I mentioned before, social benefits, healthcare, housing, you know, automotive rights, you know, trucker protests, strikes, that kind of thing, right? That have consistently forced the Kremlin to back down, right? And again, most recently, you know, around COVID-19 restrictions, right? This, you know, is the kind of thing that could force the Kremlin to do that, in which case the Kremlin is going to have to decide, you know, whether or not this is important enough for it to stick to its guns, in which case it's going to have to use force much more at home, right, than it has generally done even up to date, right? And the regime obviously has become increasingly repressive and increasingly willing to use force against protesters and civilian populations at home in recent months and years, right? That said, right, I think it's much more likely that public unrest forces the regime to backtrack on the draft and then to seek kind of a ceasefire in Ukraine, rather than leading to some kind of revolutionary instability. You know, the Kremlin, you know, aside from controlling a police state, which it can decide how to use, you know, does control, you know, the commanding heights of pretty much everything, right? And not even just the commanding heights, right? It controls the television and much of the traffic on the internet. It controls all the political parties in the Duma. It controls the education system, right? It has the ability, as a result, to pivot rhetorically and in terms of propaganda at home if it wants to, right? And it, you know, anything short, I think, of losing control of the territory it had on the 23rd of February 2022, it will be able to claim as a victory, right? And there will be some who will kind of snipe at the margins, but they'll be able to withstand that. So I don't think that a failure of you know, military mobilization has to necessarily lead to sort of a revolutionary scenario in Russia, in which case, you know, all of the questions that you raise about, you know, who would succeed him and that kind of thing, you know, would become relevant. I don't think it's potentially that destabilizing. But again, you know, it's the only thing harder to predict than a war is a revolution, and so I don't want to go too far on a limb in terms of projecting this into the future.
Okay, Sam, thanks very much. And I'm going to be very generous with your insight and let Piotr ask a follow-up question.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate that. No, I understand, Sam. It's not an easy question. The thing about Russia is I think the West does have a degree of hubris. They assumed that sort of when Russia left the Soviet Union and was sort of going to join the international system like China, that it would sort of become a full-fledged democracy in the model of the West. And I don't think that that's ever something that was going to happen. Russia might have its own interpretation of democracy. But now we've got this situation where We don't have a clear alternative. And I'm really not sure in terms of partial or, let's be honest, full-scale mass mobilization is going to really lead to some kind of systemic change in attitudes. So Russia is now going to become a bit of a vassal state, a bit of a husk. And I'm just wondering what you think that means for sort of other countries that are dependent upon Russia for support, and broadly just China specifically, but also India and some of the Central Asian states. If we could just drill down a little bit more into what you think it means for Russian role as a stabilization force in other parts of the globe. Whether we like it or not, they are a P5 member and they do have a lot of say in other files in other regions. And if there's a chaos at home, it's going to make their ability to conduct foreign policy that much harder. So I'm just curious if you could expand a little bit on that. If not, I appreciate that. It's not an easy question.
Yeah, look, it is a very, very big question. And again, I'm going to avoid for the moment, or at least for this conversation, right, the question about, you know, sort of Russian approaches to democracy. Other than to say that, like, I'm not a cultural essentialist, right? So while I take your point on hubris, and I think you're right that, you know, there was kind of a facile assumption that Russia was going to become like us, whatever like us might mean, right? I wouldn't run too far in the other direction and say that Russians are so fundamentally different, right, that they don't want the same things that kind of most people around the world do, which is to live in prosperity and security and generally speaking, that's, you know, better done when you don't have a repressive government. I think, you know, the broader point, the other point you make sort of on the geopolitical one is a very important one, right? It was just January of this year, although it feels like ages ago, right, that it took Russian military involvement to prop up the Tokayev government in Kazakhstan, right? It wasn't all that long ago that the same kind of thing was needed in Belarus, and to a large extent, you know, the Armenian government owes its existence at the moment to Russian support, and so you know, I think it is very reasonable, right, to raise the question of what's happening in those areas. It's something I think we as analysts and governments are not paying enough attention to, not least because, you know, while Russia has been able to cushion itself from the impact of sanctions and sort of global isolation, through its reserves, right? Kazakhstan, Armenia, Belarus, others have actually been hit much harder, right? And those same socioeconomic factors that led to political dissatisfaction there and undermined governments there, right, will eventually come back to the fore, right? At a time when, you know, Rosguardia is not going to be there to prop these regimes up, right? And I think that's part of the reason why, you know, just recently, again, we've begun to see, you know, the Kazakhs, for example, you know, begin to pivot a little bit, right, and return to earlier strategies of, yes, of course, you're going to want to have a good, you know, strong relationship with Moscow. It's the neighborhood that you're in, right? But you need to be able to balance that, right? You need to be able to, you know, obviously have a good and productive relationship with China if you're in that neighborhood, right? But you also want to balance that with good and productive relationships with Washington and with Brussels. And we're beginning to see, I think, the first, you know, signs of that happening again, right? Again, I don't think that, in fact, you know, we need to see that as something that's revolutionary. I think that's a return to kind of the way that the game was played up until very, very recently, when some of these regimes became extraordinarily beholden to Moscow. I think this actually can, you know, return to some stability in the region. It can at least be a source of stability if these regimes are more autonomous and more able to balance in a global system. But, you know, coming way back to the beginning of this whole conversation, you know, when Steve framed this as, has this been a mistake? One of the things that this has done, right, has been to undermine Russian power in the region and in the world. Any soft power that it had, and it had built some, right, has been greatly undermined by this war, and its ability to sort of, you know, to walk and chew gum, right, to help settle conflicts in various parts of the world has also been undermined, right? that's a hit that they're going to take. And it's unfortunately, you know, for the Russians, or fortunately, depending on how you want to look at it, going to take quite some time, I think, for them to you know, return to being seen as a reliable partner.
All right, that is a fascinating answer that I think, as you say, kind of takes us full circle, and we really are running out of time. You know, that sort of gives a picture of how this fits in even in a wider way, and in the region. And we really are running short of time, so I am going to wrap it up here. Sam, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you very much, and thanks to everybody who tuned in.
All right. Yes, thanks very much for tuning in and for your questions. Once again, I've been speaking to Sam Green, a professor at the Russia Institute at King's College London, director of Democratic Resilience at the Center for European Policy Analysis, and co-author of the book Putin versus the People, a title that I think is quite apt right now. My name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL. As I mentioned at the start, this conversation will also be published as a podcast, and you can subscribe to The Week Ahead in Russia and other RFERL podcasts wherever you listen to podcasts, Apple, Spotify, Google, and more. I'll be back next Monday for another edition of The Week Ahead in Russia. And please have a look at my newsletter, The Week in Russia, which comes out next on Friday, October 7th. Thanks for listening.